The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon. How good are gummy supplements? Question. I always take my vitamins if they are gummies. I might be persuaded to change if gummies aren't good for me. The four gummies I take are calcium, vitamin D3, CoQ10, and a multivitamin. What do you think of gummy supplements? One of the few organizations that test vitamins and other dietary supplements is ConsumerLab.com. After testing gummy multivitamins, it reported that, quote, some gummy supplements, particularly gummy multivitamins, do not contain their listed amounts of vitamins or minerals or contain impurities, unquote. It noted that 80% of the gummy products tested failed because they contained too much or too little of certain listed ingredients. You can find the full report at ConsumerLab.com. There is also a subscription fee to access the full report. Question. For years, I suffered with hypothyroidism. My doctors prescribed T4 drugs like Synthroid, Levothyroid, and generic levothyroxine, but I was still depressed. Also, I lost a lot of hair. T4 was not working well for me, so I asked for Armour Thyroid. After I started on that, the improvement was almost instantaneous. Unfortunately, endocrinologists don't like it. One even told me that it was an antiquated treatment. I think it is a shame so few doctors seem to appreciate the value of treating with both T3 and T4. I feel much better when I'm on Armour, and it's spelled A-R-M-O-U-R, Thyroid. The answer? Hypothyroidism caused by an underactive thyroid gland is quite common. If your thyroid gland were functioning normally, it would produce both T4, levothyroxine, and T3, triiodothyroxine. These are thyroid hormones that affect how every part of the body works. The numbers indicate how many atoms of iodine each contains. In most people, body tissues are able to convert T4, which is inactive, into active T3 hormone by removing one iodine atom. Some individuals don't do that efficiently, however, and we suspect that these are the ones who feel better on a product with both T3 and T4 hormones. Armour Thyroid is desiccated thyroid gland from pigs. It does provide T3 as well as T4. The endocrinologists are right that it is old-fashioned. That doesn't mean it isn't helpful for patients like you. You can learn more about symptoms of hypothyroidism and its treatment, including desiccated thyroid, from our, quote, Guide to Thyroid Hormones, unquote. It's available at peoplepharmacy.com. What foods may trigger migraine headaches? Question. My husband used to get migraines. I decided to see if it was related to food. For a two-month period, I wrote down what he ate every day. We discovered that within 3 days of each migraine, he had eaten Chinese food, salted peanuts, sharp cheese, or a frozen lasagna. We switched to fewer frozen entrees, moderated consumption of cheese and peanuts, and asked for no MSG in our Chinese food. As a result, his migraines went from once a month to only two a year. Headache answer. Headache specialists consider food triggers for migraine to be controversial, and that's cited in the journal Headache, October 2016. That's because there are relatively few well-controlled scientific studies of dietary triggers. That said, there is general recognition that some people may be susceptible to certain foods. Among the most common culprits are alcohol, chocolate, aged cheese, MSG, which is monosodium glutamate, nuts, salami, nitrate preservatives, and artificial sweeteners such as aspartame. A food diary of the sort you kept is a very good way to uncover migraine triggers for a given individual. You can learn more about food triggers, a connection between celiac disease and migraines, and non-drug approaches that can help prevent migraines in our, quote, guide to headaches and migraines. Question. I cure my cold sores with lemon balm. It comes as a salve, and I apply it once or twice a day. As soon as I feel a tingle, the cold sore never appears. Lemon balm, or Melissa officinalis, has traditionally been used against cold sores. These are caused by herpes simplex virus. Scientists have studied lemon balm extract and found that it helps keep HSV, or herpes simplex virus 1, from penetrating cells. That's cited in the journal Phytotherapy Research, October 2014. A review of research concluded that Melissa officinalis and certain other botanicals hold promise against HSV-1, and that's cited in the Avicenna Journal of Phytomedicine, September to October 2016. From the Costco Connection, which is best for your pain? Analgesic answers. When you have pain, you may find the large number of over-the-counter analgesics overwhelming. And how do you know if you can manage with an over-the-counter analgesic or if you need something stronger, such as a prescription analgesic? Here's a quick primer with information from anesthesiologists and pain management experts that may help you to decide. So what type of pain do you have? The first is simple superficial pain. Non-steroidals, anti-inflammatories, NSAIDs, may help with aches and pains, strains, anything that could be inflammatory in nature. Over-the-counter, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories such as ibuprofen, naproxen, and aspirin. NSAIDs often work best for treating pain caused by inflammation, such as sprains, toothaches, headaches, backaches, and even arthritis. Acetaminophen, or Tylenol, can also treat pain from headaches and arthritis, but it doesn't reduce inflammation and swelling. The most common side effects of NSAIDs is stomach upset. NSAIDs can react with anticoagulants or blood thinners and are metabolized through the kidneys. So if you have kidney disease, your doctor may advise against taking NSAIDs. Acetaminophen doesn't upset the stomach the way NSAIDs do, but large doses can affect your liver. And then the other type of pain, nerve pain, where it is more of a sharp shooting sensation or a pain that radiates from one location to another, and that may require prescription medication. A prescription NSAID for mild to moderate pain may help if you have pain that isn't responding to over-the-counter medications. Opioids, which are narcotics, are prescribed alone or in combination with acetaminophen. Opioids treat more serious or severe pain caused by injury, surgery, or illness. They are usually meant for short-term use only as long-term use, commonly prescribed for long-term chronic cancer pain, carries a risk of physical dependence or addiction. Other prescription medications such as antidepressants and anti-seizure drugs may also be prescribed for pain if you have neuropathic nerve pain or chronic pain that doesn't respond to these analgesics. Other prescription drugs such as antidepressants and anti-seizure medications may help. The side effects from prescription drugs vary widely depending on the medication and the dose, but the most common ones are sedation, nausea and vomiting, constipation, and the potential for addiction. Growth factors dealing with hair loss. This is also the Costco Connection. At first, the signs were subtle. Christina, 35, noticed an increasing amount of hair in her hairbrush, and her hair seemed thinner than usual. A year later, she realized she was experiencing gradual but steadily increasing hair loss, including a bald spot near her crown. She has androgenetic alopecia, the most common cause of hair loss. It affects 50 million men and 30 million women in the United States. An inherited condition, androgenetic Alopecia, also called male or female pattern hair loss, usually occurs after age 50, but it can begin as early as young adulthood, according to the National Institutes of Health. More than just a physical change, Christina, a single mother, has found it difficult to cope with her hair loss. After I was diagnosed, my self-esteem went down the toilet, she says. I felt embarrassed about how my hair looked, especially on dates. It's a tough topic to talk about. Hair loss can certainly be disheartening and can cause anxiety and embarrassment, particularly for women. For many of the women I treat, their hair loss is devastating, says Dr. Shani Francis, medical director of Ashura Dermatology and clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Hair is often the foundation of a woman's self-identity and femininity. Treatment options. There are two Food and Drug Administration approved pharmaceutical products for androgenetic alopecia. Minoxidil, a lotion or foam available in 2% and 5% strengths, must be applied to the scalp once or twice daily. Oral finasteride, also marketed as Propecia, at 1 milligram strength, is FDA approved for use by men but cannot be used by women because it causes birth defects. Although these two pharmaceuticals are considered among the most effective treatments for male or female pattern hair loss, they do have disadvantages. Minoxidil, particularly in lotion form, can cause itching and rashes in some people, and finasteride may produce the side effect of sexual dysfunction in men. With minoxidil, some hair growth occurs in most people to varying degrees, yet real improvements are not seen for at least 4 months, and sometimes up to a year, says Dr. Michelle Gallant, professor of dermatology at Stanford University. Other alternatives. Some studies have found that other drugs are useful for hair loss, including oral spironolactone and oral contraceptives for women, and topical latanoprost for both men and women. Laser combs, laser helmets, and other laser devices for hair loss may also be helpful. They emit a low level of laser light that may help stimulate hair growth and can be used without a prescription at home. Lasers used with minoxidil can also have a synergistic effect that may lead to increased hair growth, Francis says. Most current treatments, such as minoxidil and lasers, need to be used continuously to sustain the effect. Once stopped, the hair loss will continue to progress. What patients don't realize is that treating hair loss can mean a lifelong commitment, and you have to be consistent and patient. Transplants and cover-ups. Of all treatments, hair transplants are often the most effective, resulting in the greatest amount of hair regrowth. In these procedures, hair is transplanted from one part of the scalp to areas where there is thinning or baldness. A hair transplant procedure can take 4 to 8 hours, since it is performed by harvesting and transplanting single hair follicles consecutively, but complications are rare. It can take up to 6 to 9 months for patients to see significant hair growth after surgery. If all else fails, wigs and toppers, partial wigs that usually cover the top of the head, can be used to cover up hair loss. Powders and spray-on topical hair fiber products can also make thinning hair appear fuller, but they must be applied to existing hair to provide coverage. Most studies have not found any beneficial effect from using supplements and shampoos said to thicken and grow hair. Research continues. The good news is that research continues to delve into new treatments for hair loss, including stem cell therapies and platelet-rich plasma therapy. One of the newest treatments for hair loss, platelet-rich plasma therapy, is now being used by dermatologists. With PRP treatments, the patient's blood is used to formulate a concentration of platelets that are injected into the areas of hair loss. This may help retain and thicken the hair that one currently has and may lead to regrowth of new hair, says Dr. Mark Glassifer, a dermatologist specializing in hair loss, who practices in northern New Jersey. The Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Fungal pneumonia. Unusual suspects. Sometimes when antibiotics aren't working to cure a bout of pneumonia, it might be a case in which the usual bacterial or viral suspects aren't the guilty parties. In fact, the culprit may be hidden in plain sight. Fungi are everywhere and typically don't cause problems for people with healthy immune systems. But in a small portion of pneumonia cases, fungi can be to blame. If so, treatment must include antifungal medicines. There are generally two categories of fungi that can infect the lungs and cause pneumonia. One kind is opportunistic. Opportunistic fungi are very common and pose little threat to healthy people, but they can be extremely dangerous to those with weakened immune systems, including people who are elderly, are receiving treatments for certain cancers, are taking corticosteroids or immunodeletory drugs such as tumor necrosis factor alpha or TNF-alpha, have an underlying lung disease or a condition that impairs immunity, such as sickle cell disease or human immunodeficiency virus or HIV or AIDS. Another kind of fungal infection is endemic to certain areas. This kind of fungi can affect anyone, but as with opportunistic fungi, it's more of a threat to people who are immunocompromised. Since fungi are everywhere, it's important for those with weakened immune systems to take steps to minimize exposure to fungal spores. Sometimes problematic. Fungal lung infections can occur when you breathe in yeast or spores of certain fungi that have been disturbed in the soil and are circulating in the air. This might happen during farming, construction work, landscaping, hiking, gardening, or other outdoor activities. Exposure is common in areas where fungi are endemic. Infections can range from mild to severe, depending on the health of your immune system or the amount of fungi you're exposed to. Fungal pneumonia can be hard to distinguish from other forms of pneumonia because it produces many of the same signs and symptoms: fever, cough, shortness of breath, headache, fatigue, and chest pain. A fungal infection may be suspected when pneumonia persists over several weeks, despite treatment with antibiotics. At its most severe, a fungal lung infection spreads throughout the body, possibly infecting the bloodstream or causing permanent damage to other organs and bones. In some cases, it may be fatal. Common types. Some of the more common fungal lung infections in the U.S. include aspergillosis, the fungus Aspergillus, or Aspergillus, is found virtually everywhere, in soil, plants, and house dust. Although not a problem for most people, Aspergillus can trigger an allergic reaction in people who have asthma, while others develop mild to serious lung infections. Invasive Aspergillus occurs when the infection spreads to blood vessels and beyond. For those with compromised immune systems, especially stem cell and organ transplant recipients, invasive Aspergillus can be life-threatening. Pneumocystis pneumonia. Pneumocystis gyrovesicae is an opportunistic fungus that affected many people living with HIV or AIDS before the advent of antiretroviral therapy and preventive HIV or AIDS treatment. It's still a common cause of pneumonia in people with weakened immune systems, and it's rare. Its rate is increasing among people without HIV or AIDS, including people who take prednisone or other immunosuppressive drugs. If you're on a long-term steroid regimen, more than a few weeks, or if you're taking intermittent high doses of an immunosuppressive drug, such as chemotherapy, talk to your doctor about taking a medication to help prevent pneumocystis pneumonia. Histoplasmosis. This infection is caused by the fungus Histoplasma capsulatum, which is endemic to the East and Central U.S. and Central America. This fungus thrives in soil containing large amounts of bat and bird droppings, such as under trees and in abandoned buildings and caves. Blastomycosis. This is caused by Blastomyces dermatitis, a fungus that thrives in soil and decaying wood, especially along waterways. It's found in woodland soil in the southeastern and midwestern U.S., particularly in states that border the Mississippi River Basin. Coccidioidomycosis. This infection, also known as valley fever, V-A-L-L-E-Y, valley fever, is caused by the fungi Coccidioides imitis and Coccidioides poecidalsal. These fungi live primarily in the soil of arid parts of the southwestern U.S., Mexico, and South America. More cases are being reported in older adults who move to these areas when they retire. Lifelong residents of these areas are typically infected as children and have only mild symptoms, if any. Treatment and prevention. Most people live near fungi their entire lives and never think twice about it. But if you have a condition or take a medication that impairs your immune system, or if you spend or have spent a lot of time outdoors in areas where certain fungi are prominent, it's important to consider fungi a possible cause of lung infection. Sometimes a fungal lung infection may lie dormant, not causing symptoms until years later, when your immune defenses are lower for some reason. If you've had signs and symptoms of flu or pneumonia that persist despite treatment, such as with antibiotics, talk to your doctor about the possibility of a fungal lung infection. Be sure to mention places you've traveled or lived previously, or an occupation or hobby that may have put you at risk. Your doctor may order a chest x-ray or computerized tomography, CT scan, and tests of sputum, blood, urine, or spinal fluid to determine if there's a fungus present. Treatment is based on symptoms and the health of your immune system. If you have no symptoms, or your symptoms are very mild and you're generally in good health, you may not need to take anything. For persistent or moderate to severe symptoms, your doctor will likely recommend one or more antifungal medicines. Corticosteroids are helpful for allergic reactions. Pneumocystitis. Pneumonia is usually treated with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, which is Bactrim or Ceftra. Antifungals are typically taken for several months and sometimes years. Examples include voriconazole, which is V-F-E-N-D, itraconazole, Sporinex, or Onmel, O-N-M-E-L, fluconazole, which is Diflucan, and others. In some severe cases, treatment may start with intravenous amphotericin B and then be followed by one of the other antifungals. Amphotericin B is more toxic than other antifungals, but can be more effective in clearing the fungus. Treatment generally eliminates the fungus, but the lesions or masses that fungi sometimes produce on your lungs may remain. These lesions often calcify and don't cause long-term problems, but in some cases they may need to be surgically removed. If your immune system is vulnerable because of medications or a chronic condition, avoid activities that involve digging in soil or disturbing ground covering, such as clearing shrubs and debris, cleaning out barns, exploring caves, or renovating old buildings. You can't always prevent breathing in fungal spores, but you might be able to minimize your exposure. In certain people who are severely immunocompromised, a regimen of antifungal medications may be appropriate as preventive therapy. Giant cell arteritis, new treatment for inflammation. Weight gain, high blood pressure, thinning bones, these are just some of the side effects you've struggled with while taking prednisone therapy to treat your giant cell arteritis. In addition to the side effects as you've been experiencing, the prednisone hasn't stopped the disease from flaring up. Now your doctor is recommending that you add a new treatment called tocilizumab or Actemra, A-C-T-E-M-R-A, to address these issues. Giant cell arteritis, also called temporal arteritis, is an inflammatory disorder that triggers swelling and narrowing of medium and large-sized blood vessels, particularly those in the temporal areas of the head. The swelling makes it difficult for blood to flow through the blood vessels. This can cause symptoms such as headaches, scalp tenderness, and pain when chewing. Many people also experience fever, fatigue, and weight loss. Over the years, research has centered on finding safer and more effective treatment options for the disorder, without much success. But that may have changed. Based on promising clinical trial results, the Food and Drug Administration approved tocilizumab, the first therapy that specifically targets giant cell arteritis. Let me spell that. T-O-C-I-L-I-Z-U-M-A-B. Already approved to treat conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, it blocks interleukin-6, a protein secreted by immune cells believed to play a role in chronic inflammation. People with giant cell arteritis tend to have higher concentrations of interleukin-6 in their systems. The approval comes after more than 60 years of focusing on corticosteroids such as prednisone as the only option to manage giant cell arteritis. Typically, corticosteroids are started at high doses and then gradually scale back over several months. But this is fraught with problems. Moderate to severe corticosteroid treatment-related side effects occur in at least 75% of people who have giant cell arteritis. Complications. Without proper treatment, giant cell arteritis can cause significant problems, blindness in one or both eyes. In 20% of cases, people with giant cell arteritis also are at substantially increased risk of developing a weakened or bulging spot in a major blood vessel, which is an aortic aneurysm. An aneurysm can burst, which is often fatal. There's also an increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. Because of the complications associated with the disorder and corticosteroids, traditional treatment has long been aggressive yet delicate, balancing act using prednisone. But since relapses are common, many people with this disease will eventually need to go back to a higher dose of steroids to get it under control. Average treatment time using corticosteroids is about 2 years, but some people may need treatment for 5 years or longer. A new hope for giant cell arteritis treatment, tocilizumab, is used along with daily oral corticosteroid therapy. It is injected once a week with every other week in single dose. Corticosteroid doses are tapered until no longer needed, and at this point, tocilizumab may be continued or stopped. In a clinical trial, more than half of the 149 people who took the drug had their disease under control after 1 year. That's compared with 20% or less than 20% taking corticosteroids only. It can affect the liver, cholesterol levels, and the immune system, requiring regular monitoring of liver function, cholesterol levels, and white blood cell and platelet counts. If you struggle with giant cell arteritis, relapses, and corticosteroid complications, it may be worth discussing your options with your doctor. Next time, we will review the Harvard Health Letter and further medical topics of interest. So we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And stay healthy.